Who comes to speak before Queen Hippolyta, Imperial Leader of the Amazons?
My name is Scott Smallstig. I'm from the Muncie, Indiana Chamber of Commerce.
I am Queen Hippolyta. Kneel before me, bug-like noodle man.
Sure thing, Your Highness. I was asked to meet with you about relocating your new headquarters in Muncie. We have some great industrial parks I'd like to—
Silence! Before any man speaks to me, he must eat the raw, quivering heart of an adult horse.
I take a statin?
We have learned this word, and we know of your puny weakness like a scuttling cockroach. Please sign and initial this waiver, indicating you were offered a fresh horse heart and elected not to eat it because you have the spirit of a baby fruit fly.
Fair enough. Can I get back to talking about what I like to call Muncie living? I haven't mentioned the top-notch symphony or the rollerblading on the Greenway.
Silence! Calliope, read them the list of our demands as Amazons.
We require open carry laws for bow and arrow, open carry laws for spears, open carry laws for lances, curved swords, straight swords, long knives, short knives, double-sided axes, single-sided axes, bolos, nunchucks, warhammers.
I get your drift. I think I can speak for Governor Holcomb and say a big yes to all that.
Who is Bubblegum Hole Foam?
No, Governor Holcomb. Eric Holcomb. He's our leader.
Excellent. Upon my arrival, I will kill him and take his tiny sack of man treasures to impregnate Katniss Everdeen, who will rule with me for 100 years as my best girlfriend.
Certain aspects of that plan may be unworkable.
Do you deny me my Katniss Everdeen, worm boy?
It's just that she's not a real—
Kill him! You know what? Now I've got one of those cluster headaches. Do any of you have some Aleve? And give me some of that Muncie guy's blood to wash it down. No way we're moving there. In fact, let's stop giving them free two-day delivery. And now a tiny useless man with a mouse dropping for a heart. Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, I resemble that remark. All right, so yes, there's been an awful lot of talk about Amazon and Amazons in the news. Well, mainly Amazon, actually, in the news, especially these days. But we're not talking about the company. We're not even talking about the river. We're talking about the legend, except it's not strictly a legend, from whence all of that verbiage flows. We're going to talk about the Amazon women. We're going to talk about what they were in legend and then what we know of them in reality, because, yes, there is a reality. And then towards the end, we'll talk a little bit about how they manifest themselves in modern culture. There's obviously one very prominent example. Anyway, let me tell you who's going to be doing the talking. Joining us from KPBS Studios in San Diego is Walter Penrose Jr., Associate Professor of History at San Diego State University and the author of Postcolonial Amazons, Female Masculinity and Courage in Ancient Greek and Sanskrit Thought. And joining us by phone, Adrienne Mayer, folklorist, science historian and research scholar at Stanford University. She's the author of The Amazons, Lives and Legends of Warrior Women Across the Ancient World. So I want to begin with a legend and then move towards the historical reality. Adrienne Mayer, maybe you can kick this thing off for us. Before we get to that historical reality, what was in the ancient world the legend of the Amazons?
Well, the Amazons in Greek myth and oral stories, Amazons were fierce warrior women dwelling in exotic eastern lands around the Black Sea and beyond, all the way across Asia, a mysterious land to the Greeks. They were the mythic arch enemies of the ancient Greeks, the greatest heroes of Greek myth, Heracles, Theseus, Achilles. Every one of them had to prove their courage by a battle with Amazons, or actually a duel with an Amazon queen. It's interesting, we have the names of all the Amazon queens, Hippolyta, Antiope, Penthesilea, but we also have the names of more than 200 ancient Amazons from antiquity. That shows just how popular those stories were. And Amazons played an important role in the legendary Trojan War. They fought as allies of the Trojans, so they killed a lot of Greeks there. That's where Achilles and Penthesilea had their duel. Penthesilea lost. The city of Athens itself, they believed that their first citizens, that their founders, had been victorious over a powerful Amazon army that had actually invaded Greece. That's a tale from the Golden Age of myth, but they believed in it. Every man, woman, boy, and girl knew Amazon stories by heart. And, of course, they were just wildly popular in ancient Greek artworks, sculpture, paintings, and figures on pottery.
I want to come back to that whole idea of everybody knowing about it. But Walter Penrose, I want to get you to emphasize something that Adrian is also talking about, which is that unlike a lot of foes who might be depicted in legend, my sense is that the Greek legends about the Amazons were, for the most part, admiring, right? It was they weren't disgusting, depraved, debauched, inferior. If anything, they were superior.
Yes, the Amazons were considered to be valiant foes by the Greeks. I think the Greeks were fascinated with the Amazons. And the Amazons, however, did in Greek legend feminize the men that lived in the areas where the Amazons lived. So that would be, in the area of ancient Turkey along the coast of the Black Sea. And so the Amazons were considered to be faster, better, and smarter than men by the ancient orator Lysias. They harnessed the use of iron. He said they were the first to do so, and that was how they defeated their enemies. Also, they were more ingenious. And so what happened is that the Amazons did, as Adrian said, eventually march on Athens and were defeated by the Greeks, right? But the Greeks were the only men, according to the story, who were valiant enough to defeat these women. And there's even one version of the legend preserved by Plutarch in which the Athenians can't defeat the Amazons. They have to sign a truce with them, and then the Amazons go home.
You know, Walter, maybe a hint, and I don't want to get into the historical reality yet, but a hint that maybe some of this is informed by historical reality is that in some of the legends, when the Amazons attack Athens, they have Scythians at their side, right?
That's correct. And without getting into the historical basis, the Greeks also preserved legends that the Scythians were the first to harness the use of iron weapons, right, and to smelt iron and make weapons from that. And if we compare the legends of the Amazons to the legends of the Scythians, just those preserved in Greek folklore, the Amazons do the same things as the Scythians. As I've said it in my book, there are parallel narratives. So the Amazons, harness the use of iron, they conquer great swaths of territory, and the Scythians do the same thing.
All right, so remember those Scythians, or we're going to be coming back to them. Adrian, I want you to maybe elaborate a little bit more on, you see the ancient Greeks, they wouldn't have regarded the Amazons at all as a legend, right? They wouldn't have regarded them as part of, their historical heritage.
They certainly believed the myth about Amazons invading Athens. I mean, they portrayed that glorious moment in their remote past that was depicted on the Acropolis, on the great Metopes, on the Acropolis, so that everyone could see the images of Greek warriors fighting these war-loving Amazons who were the equals of men in courage and skill. They also Amazon battles decorated the great shield of Athena inside the Parthenon, and there were public paintings of Amazons fighting Greek warriors. They certainly depicted them as Walter said, as noble and attractive and even desirable, and yet they're deadly foreign women, barbarian women. In antiquity, barbarian meant any non-Greek. So they certainly did depict them as heroic, brave, desirable, and yet we don't have a single story or instance in Greek art where an Amazon is allowed to emerge victorious. They're all doomed to die at the hands of Greek heroes. That's not so unusual. They're foreign enemies, of course. But the Greeks certainly had a feeling of awe, respect, and fear, kind of mixed feelings there about these strong women.
Right. I don't know where I read this, Adrian, but I feel like I read somewhere that in Persian and Egyptian legend, there were Amazons or Amazon types too, but they were maybe depicted a little bit differently and weren't always so ultimately vanquished.
That's right. The Greeks did not have a monopoly on Amazon-like women. In traditions and stories and myths. There are stories about warlike women across the ancient world, from Egypt to Persia and Central Asia and all the way to India and China. I think Walter can talk about India for sure. But the stories are very different, very radically different outcomes. Instead of the typical Greek zero-sum game where there can only be one victor, these other cultures, non-Greek cultures, talked about Amazons and warrior women in the same way. They admired their bravery and skills, but they describe a kind of rapprochement between equals. In the stories of the combat, they're so equally matched that no one can win. Usually the duel ends in a draw, and sometimes the two former enemies decide that they'll go on and as companions in love and war and fight other enemies together. So in the non-Greek stories, there's a little more of a little more of openness to egalitarian relationships.
So, Walter, I'm a man of a certain age. I certainly grew up reading about Amazons, but I read about them in books of mythology. I read Wonder Woman comic books, too, but I read a lot of books of mythology, and I regarded Amazons strictly as part of mythology. Now, I was a boy, but I wouldn't be all that different, say, in 1960 or 1970 from a typical American scholar of antiquity or even a lot of Western scholars of antiquity who would have said the same thing about the Amazons. What's weird is there were a bunch of people who weren't saying that. They were Russian scholars. So explain that dichotomy.
That's right, Colin. So going all the way back to the 1880s, we have a very interesting character named Count Bobrinsky. Count Bobrinsky, as far as I'm aware, was the first archaeologist to find and excavate graves of quote-unquote Amazons and women buried with weapons. It were Scythian women, as far as we know now. And he published a book about this in Russian. It was not well known in the West. In fact, at the same time, the Europeans were focusing on myth, right? Thinking about myth as something that was part of the Greek national consciousness, right? In a nationalist sort of way, and ignoring the rest of the world. And so what happened is that many skeletons that were found with weapons were just assumed to be males, even in Russia. But as time went on, Soviet scholars began realizing that there was a way to sex skeletons, right? Using the bones and pelvises and the cranium. And by the 1950s, the Soviets were on to the fact that there were women warriors that were buried. And some of the excavations that were done have been reassessed. And we now know that there were considerable numbers of women warriors among the Scythians and Sarmatians, something like 20 to 37% given the excavation site. And so while the Russians and the Soviets after them were busy digging up graves of Amazons, right? And what they called Amazons. In the West, scholars were denying that the Amazons ever existed, particularly in the 1980s. There was a real pushback against feminism, right? And the women's lib movement. And scholars, particularly in the fields of classics, argued that the Amazons were an imagined other, that the Greeks had developed this idea of the Amazons in their head to define their own norms through inversion, through an opposite.
So, but then, okay, let's turn the dial way, way back to Herodotus. So Herodotus is writing histories of the ancient world as a member of the ancient world, but he's got kind of a vivid imagination. He's a little bit of a gossip in some ways, but I mean, he's got them, right? He's got a story of Amazons. What is the history of Amazons per Herodotus?
Well, it's interesting that Herodotus was, even in antiquity, sometimes considered to be a writer who exaggerated things or maybe repeated travelers' tales. But archaeology over the past few decades is proving Herodotus right in many of his statements, especially about Scythians. The excavations of Scythian kurgans or grave mounds are showing that he had a lot of details right. And it's interesting, while Walter says that points out that the Soviets were already on the idea that there really were warrior women among the Scythians because of the graves they were finding, it's interesting that Herodotus, Strabo, Diodorus, and even Plato and other ancient writers were describing real women among the nomadic tribes of Scythians who were living the lives exactly like mythic Amazons, but on the steppes of Eurasia. So these ancient writers were, they had no doubt that Amazons really existed because they were describing the lives of these warlike women who rode to war alongside the men, went hunting, rode horses, were skilled with bow and arrow, just as deadly as the men. So even in antiquity, historians were writing about warrior women among the Scythian tribes who matched the descriptions of Amazons in myth.
So, and Adrian, Herodotus, he has a story that may or may not be true. He doesn't start them out there in the steppes. He starts them out, I think, in Turkey, right? And they get, it's like a version of the Amistad story or something. Don't they get captured and put on some boats that they take over?
He sort of uses as a push-off point. This is a story that he said that he learned while interviewing people along the Black Sea, around the Black Sea. The Greeks had started trade with Scythians who lived around the Black Sea area, and from these people who were semi-settled, Herodotus actually learned about stories of other Scythians who lived further away beyond the Black Sea. And one of the stories that Herodotus tells is really, it's a charming love story. It's supposedly the origin of a tribe called the Sarmatians, who were one of the large groups of Scythians. He says that he uses as the starting point a mythic story that Greeks had attacked and captured some Amazons from the southern coast, as you said, southern coast of the Black Sea, that would be northeast Turkey, and put them on their ships. But the women somehow got a hold of their weapons, rushed the Greek sailors, overcame them, killed them all, and now they're stuck on a boat in the Black Sea. They're horsewomen. They are not sailors. So they're just blown about. They don't know how to sail, and they end up in the northern shores of the Black Sea where other Scythian tribes live. They come ashore. They find some horses. They have their weapons, and now they take up their old life there and begin attacking the tribes of Scythians that live around there. And those Scythians send out a group of young men to track these women. They think that they'll make fine wives. So the Herodotus gives all the details of how they don't even speak the same language, really, but they're able to communicate enough to start meeting romantically in the woods, and they finally decide, hey, let's run away together. They do. They run north of the Black Sea and form their own tribe, and the Amazon women say, of course, we will be raising our boys and girls exactly alike. We believe in egalitarian lives, and these men agree, and they become a very famous, a notorious tribe of the Sarmatians. And this is a story from Herodotus. Herodotus did not make up the story. It may be a foundation story, but he heard it from people who lived around the Black Sea area. It's a very interesting story because it emphasizes the egalitarian nature of Scythian life. And that just makes sense for tribes that are living in such a harsh and rugged landscape and at constant war. It just makes sense to raise your boys and girls alike. They dress alike. They all learn to ride horses. They can all handle a bow and arrow. They can hunt. They can defend the tribe. It just makes sense.
Right. So let's take just a moment or two before we go to break to talk a little bit more about what these Scythians are like. As I read about these Scythians and a possible subset of them, maybe these Sarmatians, I don't know if either of you guests or either watch or read Game of Thrones, but they sound an awful lot like the Dothraki in Game of Thrones. They're really horse-based. They're nomadic, maybe unlike the Dothraki nomadic tribes, particularly in an area like that. Resources are kind of scarce. You got to become incredibly tough in order to exploit all those resources successfully without any kind of agrarian society. So, but Walter, there's other things about the Scythians that once again seem like they might have flowed from the pen of some fantasy writer. Among other things, they used cannabis, right?
Yes, yes, that's correct. Herodotus tells us that after a funeral, right, they would put cannabis on hot coals, and they would they had a tent, right, that they would then sort of get into the tent, and so the vapors would fill up the tent, and then they would cure their grief with the cannabis and then howl with joy. And archaeology has confirmed that that Scythians did use cannabis. We find residue in paraphernalia. And so this is actually something that is not a, a tall tale, and is something that, that is true.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break here. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about the purpose of these stories. I mean, one reason that they're told is because they're true. The other reason that any story is told is because it's us in some way.
Beware, beware, they're on their way, the Amazons. They don't like men, they cut them up, the Amazons. They don't wear Gucci, don't share their armpits, the Amazons.
Welcome back. This is a show about Amazons, the actual Amazons. I should say, last week we did a show about women in pants, and this show is an outgrowth of that, because in fact, one of the things that Josh Nalea, who's the episode producer on both of these shows, discovered in the Women in Pants show is that these Amazons, who A, existed to our surprise, and B, kind of wore pants or shorts or jorts or something. The carryover, maybe the through line between all those things is that there's an early Katharine Hepburn movie called The Warrior's Husband, I think it's called. And she plays an Amazon, and she wears pants. And then she just kept wearing pants. All right, so we have the two, really do have the two foremost scholars about the Amazons, as far as we can tell, Walter Penrose Jr., Associate Professor of History at San Diego State University, author of Postcolonial Amazons, Female Masculinity and Courage in Ancient Greek and Sanskrit Thought, and Adrienne Mayer, folklorist, science historian, and research scholar at Stanford University, the author of The Amazons, Lives and Legends of Warrior Women Across the Ancient World. Before we get into the purpose of these stories, what they said to the people who told them and listened to them, Adrienne, let's stay with the historical reality for a second. Adrienne, if we know that the Amazons were Scythians or some subset of Scythians, some matriarchal part of the Scythian world, what does that mean that they look like? Do we know what a Scythian of that period would, how that person would appear?
Most of the excavations of Scythian kurgans, they hold the remains of Scythian male and female, some of them warriors, most the majority of them, and so far about 300 of more than 1,000 excavations have turned out to be female burials. Those are skeletons, so we can't really recreate their facial features, but we do know that they were very robust. They were generally taller than the ancient Greeks by some inches, and that they were had evidence of riding horses for most of their lives, starting when they were very young. Now, there have been some frozen mummies found further east in Russia and Siberia, around that area, and their facial features are actually preserved. One thing we do know is that all of Scythia, which vast territory that's stretched all the way from the Black Sea to the Great Wall of China. Actually, that wall was built to keep out the nomadic tribes. We know that that was just a sort of a cauldron of so many different languages and ethnic groups. There are just really lots of descriptions of what Scythians looked like from Roman, Greek, and Chinese chronicles, saying that they had dark hair, dark eyes, light hair, green and blue eyes, very diverse group of people.
All right. So now, with all that in mind, the mythology, Walter Penrose, the mythology that I grew up reading, wasn't just about this matriarchal society of warrior women, or even a society of warrior women in which there really didn't seem to be any men at all, and women who burned one breast off so they could draw the bow better. And there's all that stuff. But there's also this sense of real antipathy towards men that seemed to be part of at least the Amazon legend that I grew up with. Was that part of the legend that the Greeks would have known at the time?
Yes, I mean, we find various manifestations of this aspect of the legend. So Aeschylus, for example, tells us that the Amazons were man-hating and man-less, right? A statement that might liken them to, you know, say, the ancient equivalent of lesbians, perhaps, right? But in other versions of the myth, we are told that they were man-loving, yet male infant-killing. And so I think that's the version that was preserved by Hellanicus in a fragment. And that, I think, we have to understand as meaning that they did, you know, have sex with men, but then they killed the, male infants, and they raised the female infants. And so, so these stories we can't confirm or deny, but yes, I think the Greeks thought that any society perhaps where women were had equality with men was perhaps foreign to the Athenians in particular. And so I think when they thought about warrior women, perhaps they kind of made up these stories in their mind because they were threatened. That's one possibility.
All right. I want to come back to some of these stories about who they copulated with and why, but we'll come to that in a second. But Adrian, one idea that you've posited is that the Amazon myths somehow or other illustrate a conflict in the Greek psyche, a yearning at some level, if only a mythic level, for some kind of gender equality. Can you talk about that?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, everyone was aware of Amazons, and everyone knew the stories of Amazons and they in Greece, and they saw pictures of Amazons over and over in the stories. We hear that Amazons are sort of doomed to die. There's no Amazon that dies of old age. They always die in battle. Well, that's exactly what a Greek warrior hopes for, to die in face-to-face battle. So right there we can see the respect and awe that the Greeks had for them. Now, when the Greeks found out about Scythians and they learned more and more about their relatively egalitarian society, they were amazed and as Walter said, probably threatened by that idea, because they kept their women fairly constricted indoors. They lived indoors. They were doing household chores, weaving, and caring for children, nothing like the life of Amazon women or real Scythian women. Now, some scholars have said that the Amazon stories, you know, with all these gruesome details that you were just mentioning, perhaps that was propaganda to discourage Greek women from wanting to be like Amazons. And yet, that is undermined by the fact that a lot of the images of audacious, bold, courageous Amazons appears on pottery that was used exclusively by women. So women had pictures of Amazons on their perfume jars, on their jewelry boxes, on various other pieces of pottery that they alone used, that men didn't use. So there's even some evidence that little girls played with Amazon dolls. If you go to the Louvre, you can see a few of them in their collection. They're terracotta dolls with movable arms and legs, just like an ancient Barbie doll, but it's an Amazon wearing a helmet and carrying weapons, and some of them you could even dress in different costumes. Now, this doesn't sound like propaganda against being like an Amazon. So there's something going on there in gender relations in ancient Greece that we just have to say it's a mystery to us.
Adrian, this story so imbued Greek society in all the ways that you just talked about, all this sort of Amazonalia one could own and one could see all the time. And my sense also is that there was an almost reality show like fascination with Amazon sex too. Like we talked about maybe with Walter, how maybe they conceived children and who they conceived them with and what they did with the male children that they didn't want. I kind of like the Strabo version where they just gave them back to the guys. Here, you take the male children. We don't want those. But there was also just sort of like, well, I mean, who do they really like having sex with? So what did the Greeks think about that?
Well, you know, the Greeks were not shy about talking about homosexuality at all. We all know that, both male and female homosexuality. So I think if they assumed that the mythic Amazons or Scythian women were lesbians or bisexual, they might have mentioned that. But there's not one ancient Greek author that mentions those kind of sexual relations among Amazons or Scythian women. So we don't know. I mean, it's entirely possible. We just don't have evidence. But this the idea that that they gave away the male children after meeting on a seasonal basis with other tribes to have feasts and parties and have sex and go home pregnant, that actually has a ring of truth. We know from comparative anthropology that did happen among Scythian tribes. It just makes, once again, makes a lot of sense. It's logical. And even the idea that they gave the boys to the other tribe, that seems to reflect a custom of fosterage. It's a way of making alliances, a way of cementing alliances, and they actually did practice that. In fact, medieval Europe practiced that too. You can find fosterage of boys being sent to live with other allies as a way of sort of ensuring that you'll remain allies. That happened in Wales and Northern Europe too.
As we're talking about this, you know, Walter, a few minutes ago I engaged in an act of Amazon stereotyping and false stereotyping at that. I mentioned the legends that I grew up with of the women who cut off one breast or burned off one breast so that they could draw the bow better. Although, as Adrian suggests, skeletons of Scythian Amazons suggests maybe some bow-leggedness from horseback riding. They don't suggest anything like this draw the bow better breast story, right?
No, they don't. So one thought I have about the term Amazon, which does mean without a breast, is that this might be a way that the Greeks referred to these women as masculine, right? Because in ancient Greece, there was a strong, particularly in Athens, there was a strong division of labor, right? Where men were in the public sphere, they made war, women lived in the domestic sphere, taking care of the household of children, sewing and weaving. And so what I think the term Amazon may refer to is masculinity in women. And my point of comparison here is a Sanskrit text in which women who were masculine are called breastless. And so there's a direct comparison made there in the Sanskrit literature. And, you know, so this is one way we might think about it, of the term, and, you know, not being something about physical attributes, although the Greek author Hellanicus does tell us that, you know, he derives an etymology of the term, saying that the alpha privative means, you know, not or without, and matzon is a variant of mastos, from which we get our word mastectomy, meaning breast. And so he does tell us that they cut their breasts off to pull the arrow back. And so there you have it.
All right, we're going to be taking a break pretty soon and maybe talking a little bit more about modern depictions of Amazons. But Adrian, before we do that, one thing that I discovered through preparation for this show and through reading about you is there's an Amazon Facebook group that's for ancient and modern Amazons. There's several people who are regular listeners to this show and even friends of the show who are members of that group. But I found myself wondering whether there are sort of Amazon reenactors. I mean, there are reenactors of everything else. There's people who dress up and act like Vikings and reenactors of every imaginable war. Have you, Adrian, come in contact with people who dress up or outfit themselves as Amazons?
Absolutely. There are several groups of very skilled horsewomen who practice horseback archery, and they can recreate all the skills that the Scythians were famous for. One of them was the Parthian shot, where you can actually be galloping away, riding a horse bareback, and shooting your arrow at people chasing you or at targets behind you. That was much dreaded by any cultures that had to fight the Scythians. And these women, I know there are groups in Washington State, in Oregon, in Texas, and in California. They're also in Iran, Japan, Hungary, various places around the world. And many of them are members of my Facebook group.
Yeah, it's a great group. So, Adrian Mayer, thank you so much. Folklorist, science historian, and a research scholar at Stanford University, author of The Amazons, Lives and Legends of Warrior Women Across the Ancient World. We've got one more segment to go here. We'll get to that in just a second, so stay with us.
Today's show is produced by a puny man, Josh Nalea, and me, Kyon Wolf. Amanda Fish is an Amazon, or at least a piranha who swims in the Amazon. The part of Bill Curry was played by Linda Carter. On tomorrow's show, another Amazon, the one named Melania. And now, back to Colin.
Yes, here's the final segment of this fascinating show about Amazons. Amazons who were a reality, a powerful legend and a reality based on all the modern archaeological evidence. So we have one more person for you to meet. That's Sean Marlon Newcomb, actor, writer, director, and co-founder of the Artemis Women in Action Film Festival. Still with us, Walter Penrose Jr., associate professor of history at San Diego State University, and author of Postcolonial Amazons, Female Masculinity and Courage in Ancient Greek and Sanskrit Thought. So before we talk to either one of you, let's hear a movie courtesy of Sean, not an entire movie. Let's hear a small segment of a movie from the documentary field of the 2015 Artemis Women in Action Film Festival. This is a winner for Best Documentary about four women boxers.
I have a Mexican-Irish background. I could either drink you under the table or I could beat the hell out of you. But I don't drink, so I guess I'll beat the hell out of you.
When she was little, one of those box things, those punching bags, she asked me, Mom, why don't you give me a punching bag? Well, I'm sorry I didn't get it, because she was very high strung, very spirited, and I think she needed to punch something.
Perfect professional record. Please welcome Maureen, the real million-dollar baby.
I thought, oh, she'll do one fight and it'll be over. And that's what I've been telling myself ever since. But I'm resigned to the fact that this is what she wants.
So, Sean Marlon Newcomb, tell us more about this film festival, the Artemis Women in Action Film Festival.
Hey, Colin, and hey to Adrian Walter. We started the festival in 2015 with the notion of how do we, in some way, create a celebration and create a community of people who support and promote these types of movies, movies which specifically feature a woman as a lead or a co-lead in a physically empowered or action role. You know, subsequently, we expanded to have also women who take action in terms of the public sphere, in terms of the political sphere, and in activism. But the centerpiece is kind of like with the Amazons, the action heroines. So for the last 3 years, we've had the festival, and what we do is, whether it's a film about an action heroine, an ancient warrior woman, a contemporary boxer, MMA fighter, a woman in the military in first response, or a stunt woman, those are the kinds of films that we ask to be submitted, and then we curate and choose the best of the best and show it to everyone. And additionally, we also honor actresses and stunt women, and also men and women, because it's important that we know that show that men support this, who create that kind of film. And then we have panels about the ancient warrior history and stunt women and women in VR, that sort of thing.
So, Walter Benrose, I know you've been on these panels and been an advisor at the film festival. You know, a name that keeps coming up, but we haven't really mentioned it here so far, is Themyscira. This is the place in the Wonder Woman movie that came out this summer. This is the home place for Wonder Woman and all of her Amazon friends and family. I think I'm told in the Justice League of America movie that's also coming out this year, there's some rumored to be some Themyscira sequences. So, Walter Penrose, what's Themyscira?
Themyscira, in ancient Greek texts, was the city, the fabled city of the Amazons. It was not on an island like in the movie, but however was on the mainland on the south shore of the Black Sea in what would be northern Turkey today. It was a city where Amazons and only Amazons lived, and it is an area that we find it of interest, right? It's the one area where we don't, or have not yet, I should say, have not yet found burials of warrior women. But hopefully that will come, because in most of the other areas associated with Amazons, particularly around the Black Sea, the Caucasus Mountains, for example, Scythia, Sarmatia, burials of warrior women have been found.
Sean Marlon Newcomb, one reason they haven't found them in Themyscira is because they haven't looked very much, right? You're planning to do something about that?
Yeah, I'd actually, and both Walter and Adrian are the inspiration for that, for having read their books and having seen it noted that no one has really, that we know of, has gone and tried to find whether there is anything there, anything that we could see that would perhaps prove some of the stories. I mean, the things I found compelling in both Walter and Adrian's books, the fact that it's not just that the Greeks identified these tribes, but also that the Persians and the Chinese and the Indians also identified these tribes and often identified them in that location around the Black Sea area. So as a filmmaker, I thought, well, this would be a great thing to do if we could tell this story, bring these great legends out, and see to what extent those legends could have were true or have any, you know, partial or pieces of truth to them. And it would just be a great way to be able to get these stories out and have people know more about some of the, what I found, really amazing things that were attributed to them that I found in both books that I read.
You know, it does seem, Sean, that as archaeology marches on, and maybe, I mean, Walter made the interesting point earlier that a lot of times, maybe in the late 19th century, early 20th century, people would find skeletons of warriors and just assume they had to be men, right? They were warriors. And that was before they started sexing skeletons, as Walter said. But now, with people's antennae up a little bit, they're maybe more likely to look for this kind of thing. I mean, wasn't there recently a Viking find?
Talk
about that.
Just saw that, just read that, and I'm sure Walter and Adrian could say, given a much more detail about this, but the find was the bones had been found earlier, I believe in the late 19th century, and it was clear from the burial that this was a high-status Viking warrior. And it was assumed, as it's always assumed, that, okay, I find bones, some weapons, some shields, that's a dude. So we're just going to assume it's a guy. But of course, now in modern times, where you can do a lot more of you can do more DNA testing and sexing of the bones, it was realized that this was actually a woman. And so this great Viking warrior of high status was actually female. And a lot of the stuff that's happened in the last 30 years has shown that, you know, we had a woman who came to our festival who I just think is amazing, and she passed away just before our last festival, Janine Davis Kimball, and she did a lot of research into the Scythian and Sarmatian warrior women, and finding and showing that a lot of these bones were actually the bones of women warriors, not simply male warriors, because you found weapons. So that's a lot of the reason why, you know, now there also seems to be something in the zeitgeist there. Okay, we're now aware, like you say, our antenna are up about this. So it's a good time to go and see what more we can find. And frankly, if any of these, if there's any truth to some of those stories and those legends, the voices of these women should be heard. And so it's up to us to bring those voices and make them heard.
You know, speaking of the zeitgeist, I mean, obviously your film festival exists to explore a certain aspect of that zeitgeist. You heard the documentary clip about the boxers who are, it's a kind of an interesting connection too. The boxer, I think we heard, was Maureen Shea.
And Jill Morley, by the way, is the director of that. She's an amazing director.
And she was Hilary Swank's sparring partner to get ready for Million Dollar Baby, which I suppose you could sort of throw in there. But it feels like, you know, that whole question of can you have a woman action hero who is no more sexualized than maybe a typical male action hero? But it does feel like in the Alien movies, particularly Sigourney Weaver putting on that big container mover exoskeleton and kicking ass, and then Linda Hamilton, especially in the second Terminator movie, where she's got these really pumped up guns. I mean, not guns that you shoot, but guns on your arms.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that there's the beginning of that, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think that what you want ideally in film and in any storytelling is that women have the same opportunity and agency as characters as men. So you don't want to desexualize them, and you also don't want to hypersexualize. You want them to have the same. I mean, James Bond is a suave and attractive action hero. You want that opportunity also to have a female James Bond of that sort, or a female quirky superhero, or a female of any type. So we're starting to see that, and as you get more stories and more characters, now you're going to hopefully have a greater array of different types of female action heroes. So you see that, you know, you have the Linda Hamilton and Sigourney Weaver, and I think those two films and those two characters really kind of broke a mold and awakened a lot of the stuff that we're seeing now. And so now that you have Wonder Woman, who is kind of was really enjoyable because she was just an old-fashioned do-gooder action heroine, and that was fantastic. And then you'll get, you know, maybe an Atomic Blonde or a Furiosa who is maybe has, you know, some damage or some complexity to it in terms of what motivates the person. So that's really the goal, to be able to just have the same opportunities to show women in action that you have with men.
Right. I mean, I was saying before you came on the show to Adrian and Walter, the Scythians strike me as very much like the Dothraki in Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones obviously has Brienne of Tarth, who's played by Gwendolyn Christie, who I think is 6'3" tall.
Yeah, yeah.
But also Arya, right? The Arya is, I mean, still, each of those women, no matter how hashtag woke that series gets, they're defying some kind of convention, even within that fictional universe.
I think Game of Thrones is extraordinary. Besides the fact that I think it's one of the greatest works of TV art ever, it also shows an array of strong female characters. I mean, basically, what are we coming to? A season of showdown between two great queens. So you have Brienne of Tarth, you have Arya, you have Cersei, who is a bad, you know, quote-unquote, depending on, so people probably root for her as well. I think she's a great character. You have Mother of Dragons, who's coming to sort of save the day. So you have all different types of women in action, women who take action in that series. I think it's extraordinary, actually.
So maybe the whole thing is coming to fruition. Thanks so much, Sean Marlon Newcomb, actor, writer, director, co-founder of the Artemis Women in Action Film Festival. Thanks to our other two guests, to Adrian Mayer and Walter Penrose Jr. Thanks to Josh. We'll be back tomorrow.
Queen Hippolyta, Lord of the Amazons, to whom am I speaking?
I bought a Samsung S7 Edge from you on August 25th, but it was not in good condition, so I emailed your customer service, and they were so rude. And
did you know that people who purchase that item also purchase the arrow you shoot through the phone and kill an idiot with?
I'm sorry, what's that?